Thank you, George and Janine. And, we are fortunate in our church that we have people of talent who are willing to share their gifts. And I think of other worship bands we've had here, Andrew and Susan and Jared and others that they can draw in to sing with them. If you have a gift or you have an inclination you'd like to share in worship in that way, I hope you'll speak to me or to one of them, because I know they'll be happy, so happy to hear from you. We live in a peculiar time, don't we, in many respects. There was a time when, I remember at school we read Shakespeare, and I remember memorizing passages of Shakespeare and other writers, science fiction, perhaps Asimov and so on. We've come to an age when we distrust words. We're not sure exactly what they mean or what is meant when they're spoken. War on drugs. War on terror. Hostility against Iran. Do they mean the same thing? What do those phrases really mean? What does it mean to make a country great again? Some say the notion is intentionally ambiguous, so we can project our own nostalgia or ideal vision of the past. What do you believe? When someone says soothingly, "I feel your pain." Have you heard that expression used to you? And you may think to yourself, what do they know about my pain? We don't want just words. We want substance. Eliza Doolittle says to her two suitors in My Fair Lady, "Words, words, words. Is that all you blighters can do? Don't talk of stars burning above. If you're in love, show me." Or I think of the English-born American poet Edgar Guest. He said he observes simple everyday things that everybody might experience, and he puts them into words and to verse. And he wrote this perhaps painful line, "I'd rather see a sermon than hear one any day." And that might strike you very much as true. We come to a story which is full of words, deep words, difficult words. But actually, it began with silence. On one side of the well was a Samaritan woman, on the other side, a Jewish man. In the time of Jesus, no respectable Jewish man would be caught dead in a conversation with a woman. He wouldn't even speak to his wife on the street in case men should gossip. There was even a group among Pharisees called the Bleeding Pharisees. Do you know why? You see, every time a woman passed by, they would shut their eyes in case they might be tempted, you see, in some way. And they would shut their eyes, and it caused them to bump into trees or to a door. And so their foreheads were always bleeding. How ridiculous. How absurd. On the other side, the status of women was so low in those days. The rabbinical schools had debates whether a woman really had a soul. And here was Jesus talking to a woman and entrusting her with profound theological truths. And furthermore, not only was she a woman, she was a Samaritan woman. In the days of Jesus, there were three distinct divisions or regions in the country. In the extreme north was Galilee, where Jesus had 95% of his work. In the extreme south was Judea, and in between lay Samaria. And if you wanted to move from Galilee to Judea, most Jews would go around the lake, around, and come back into Judea. What's the history? You see, in about 721 BC, the Assyrians had conquered the northern kingdom and carried away many of the people into their foreign land to serve as servants or slaves, and these people clung tenaciously to their faith. That's all they had. Meanwhile, in the conquered land, they were flooded with Assyrians, repopulated with Assyrians, and there was inevitably intermarriage. And they had children and grandchildren, and they were called the Samaritans. About 150 years later, when the Jews from Babylon and so on were allowed to return from captivity, they had nothing to do with the Samaritans. They were regarded as despised compromisers. They had diluted the race. And this enmity only had grown and smoldered, and prejudices deepened over the next 500 years or so. And so most Jews avoided going through Samaria. But here we have Jesus deep in Samaritan country, sitting on a well, talking to a Samaritan woman. But then, you see, Jesus was a champion of breaking down walls and barriers. He made people on the margins the heroes of his stories. Jesus told the story of a man who was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. And there he was beaten up by thieves and left for dead. And you can imagine the courage of Jesus in telling this story. And who is the hero of this story? But a Samaritan man, a Samaritan. And we call the story, of course, the story of the Good Samaritan. He is the hero. And Jesus would continually violate social, religious, and gender taboos. He would eat and drink with sinners, offer dignity and healing to lepers, foreigners, women, outsiders. He was continually embracing the marginalized. And we might ask ourselves, who are the marginalized in our culture and in our society? And here is Jesus sitting at Jacob's well and barely looking at him, with her face like flint, is a Samaritan woman. I can imagine the silence. Not gentle, tranquil silence, but cold, hard silence. Between them was a wall of silence, built brick by brick, with prejudice and hatred, through which no words really were allowed to pass. But this Jewish man speaks to this unknown woman and says to her, "Would you give me a drink of water?" And those simple words cut against the grain of culture, and the wall came tumbling down. And the woman is startled, perhaps even frightened. There's something comforting about a wall, especially when there's a stranger there and you don't know what to expect. There's a wall, there's a bit of comfort there, security. We are here, they are there. We don't have to deal with what is on the other side of the wall. And in shocked disbelief that the wall has fallen, perhaps even trying to rebuild the wall as a hiding place, she asks, "Why is it that you, a Jew, ask for water from me, a Samaritan woman?" And he replies, "If you knew who was asking, you would have asked, and he would have given you living water." Whenever you come across a reference to water in the Bible, there's probably a double meaning to that. It may mean simply the kind of water you have to slake your thirst, but it is also a metaphor for humanity's deepest and greatest need, the greatest gift that God gives of His grace. In Jeremiah 2, God is described as the fountain of living waters. But with killing literalism, the woman asks, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the water is deep. Where do you get that living water? Who do you think you are? Even Jacob, our forefather, needed a bucket. Are you greater than our forefather Jacob?" And like Nicodemus, who thought being born from above or born again meant entering into your mother's womb once again. The woman seems to miss the point in John's telling. And John seems to delight in that kind of wordplay, drinking water or that we would drink to slake our thirst, or drinking of something far greater. Then it is that Jesus tells her that he's talking about something more than mere water, and something deeper than Jacob's well. Jesus makes her an offer. Everyone who drinks of this water will never thirst again, but everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again, but those who drink of the water I give will never be thirsty. Who knows what else was said? The Gospels only offer us a summary and a commentary. At some point, the woman risks a request. Perhaps she would just play along. Give me the water, that I may never be thirsty. One can only wonder what that woman thought of this strange Jewish man. Was his mind somehow cuddled with the heat? Was he merely messing with her? And she stands there wondering, confused, cautious. And Jesus tries to get the conversation going again by saying, "Go, call your husband." And she says, "I have no husband." "You're right," he says. "You have no husband. You've had 5 husbands, and the one you are with now is not your husband. You told the truth when you said you have no husband." Most of the commentators of my age, when I went to school and earlier, were men, biblical commentators, men, well-educated men, who read, sadly, their biases into this text. Now, bear with me a little bit, and if you don't accept this, this is fine. But let me give you another alternate view of this text. They saw, you see, those commentators saw in this woman a woman who had been through a lot of tough times, and in modern terms, a woman who had perhaps been on drugs, been promiscuous, had dropped out of school early, had to care for a child whose father she could not identify. They view her as a married divorcee who would trade in husbands like a sports car. But for all their moral outrage, they missed the grim reality that only men could divorce their wives, and very easily at that. Burn the toast, and you are out the door. It's not surprising that modern scholars, many of them women, have offered us a totally different perspective. Could it be, they say, that it was the men who had failed her, making her a victim of abandonment? Perhaps she was infertile and was no use to them. Could it be that, as was common then, she was a child bride, as Mary, the mother of Jesus, and married men who were so much older? Could it be, at that time of repeating waves of war, she had lost 5 husbands? And they tell us that that really was not that strange a circumstance or unlikely. She was not a loose woman, but a respected woman who had fallen on bitterly hard and trying times. Life had not been fair to her, as life has not been fair to some of you here. She's in mourning. She does not want to be a part of that chattering group of women who would make their way to the well early in the morning before it got too hot to draw water for the day. Perhaps she was too depressed to get out of bed, so she comes alone in the heat of the day. And here at the well, she encounters this Jewish man. She is alarmed that he seems to know her history and her present circumstance. But interestingly, he does not condemn her. However, the conversation is getting a little personal, and she tries to change the subject. She says, "I see that you are truly a prophet." She's thinking, well, let's move on to safer ground here, shall we? Where do you think people should worship? Jerusalem? as you Jews do, or Mount Gerizim, that we do as Samaritans, the Presbyterian Church, or the Lutheran Church, or perhaps the Baptist Church. And Jesus interestingly honors that little diversion and takes it seriously. So let's take that diversion with them as well, because it offers to us some of Jesus' greatest teachings about the nature of worship. He let her know that where you worship, or when you worship, or even how you worship, is not as important as why you worship, and how much of yourself you give to God when you come to worship. He said, true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, with passion and deep feeling, and also informed thought and insight. Some people like all spirit, passion, and emotion flying off in all directions. It rises like a crescendo, like a blast of wind, leaving you exhausted when it is over, but none the wiser. And there are some churches on the other extreme who don't have any spirit, any sense of God's presence. They emphasize truth and order. They have words that are beautifully crafted, but they don't reach you, touch you in any meaningful way. And you could just as easily be in a dead space in a morgue. What we want in worship is something that warms your heart and leaves you awed at the wonder of God, and worship which lifts high the truth of God revealed to us in the person of Jesus Christ. The question is never, did this worship please me? But was the offering of myself pleasing to God? Was I open to God's purpose for my life? And does that submission to God and His way make a difference in the way I live? That is worship in spirit and in truth. Sometimes we ask ourselves, why is it more people don't come to worship? Perhaps you've been hurt by the church. And was it some wise person, Christina Rossetti, I think, who said, so often we are hurt as much by the church as for the church. Hurt perhaps by its politics and power plays. Or you know about hypocrisy. People perhaps close to you who are sweet and smiling on Sundays, but are bitter and angry, mean-spirited people. They grin and say their prayers on Sunday, but terrify their family behind closed doors. What is it that blocks you from true worship? Perhaps it is trauma and pain. And I've seen this happen so often. Sometimes I've gone to visit a family, and the woman, of course, is one who has come regularly to church. Her husband had been off to war and seen terrible things of which we would not speak. He would not speak either, and had no place for worship and God. I think of a young pastor of a small church who went to visit a family who had not been to church for a few years. Only the wife was at home, and she poured out the coffee, and they sat at the kitchen table and chatted. And after all the soothing pleasantries, their conversation suddenly became very serious. 2.5 years earlier, she had been at home with her young son. She was vacuuming in the back bedroom and had not checked on him for a while. So she snapped off the vacuum and went into the den and could not find him. She followed his trail across the den, through the patio doors, across the patio to the swimming pool, and that is where she found him. She said, at the funeral, our friends at the church were very kind. They told us it was God's will. And the minister put down her cup, and she reflected for a moment. Should she go there or leave well enough alone? And she decided she would go there. And she said, your friends meant well, I'm sure, but they were wrong. do you mean? She said. I mean that God does not will the death of children. And the woman's face reddened and her jaw set. Then whom do you blame? I guess you blame me. No, no, I don't blame you. But I don't blame God either. Then how do you explain it? She said, her anger rising. And the master said, I don't know. I can't explain it. I don't understand why some things happen. I only know that God's heart broke when yours did. The woman had her arms crossed, and it was clear the conversation and the visit was over. And that young minister left the house kicking herself. Why didn't I leave it alone? A few days later, the phone rang, and it was the woman. She said, we don't know where this is going, but would you come out again and talk with my husband and me? We assumed that God was angry at us. Maybe it was the other way round. What is it that keeps you from true worship and opening every room of your heart to God's presence, to God's way, to Christ and his purpose for your life? Let's go back to the gospel story for a moment. The Samaritan woman was deeply touched and impressed with all that Jesus had to say. And she said, perhaps rather philosophically, I know that one day the Messiah is coming. And when he comes, he will reveal all things to us. And Jesus said, I am he, the one who is speaking to you. And she ran to her city and told everyone. And they listened to her. And here's another telling thing about how she was regarded by the people of her city, because she was respected and responsible and valued. And when she told them she had met this person who surely was the Messiah, they came out to see Jesus and hear him for themselves. In the season of Lent, Lent is always a time when we renew our own commitments to Christ and to Jesus. I might ask of you, how is God reaching out to you? I wonder if the name Francis Thompson means anything to you. He was an English poet at the turn of the last century. He was an opium addict, was homeless on the streets, and died early at the age of 47. From TB. He writes of his own experience in an extended poem called The Hound of Heaven. He said all his life he'd been running away from God, but God was like that gentle but persistent hound of heaven who had his scent and would track him down and nudge his spirit. And I've had people tell me, you know, that has been my experience of God. I've tried to get away from God sometimes, but somehow his spirit keeps nudging me and bringing me back. God says to the one who has been run away, ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom you are seeking. Perhaps that's God's final word to you today. And the question, what is the best that you can give to him? Let's turn to prayer. In this prayer, I want to also remember that it is International Women's Day. We remember those who are hurting in our own congregation, and also the state of war in the world. O God of living water, on this International Women's Day, we give you thanks for the courage, wisdom, and faith of women in every land and generation. We remember the story of the Samaritan woman at the well, who met Jesus in the heat of the day and discovered the gift of living water. Through her, and through her voice, a whole community came to hear good news. Gracious Christ, you saw her dignity when others saw only a dividing wall. You spoke across barriers of gender, race, history, and hostility, and opened a well of hope. Today we pray for women who still carry heavy burdens, women who lead, nurture, teach, heal, and witness to your truth, women whose voices are ignored, women who long for safety, justice, and opportunity. O God, pour your Spirit upon the women and children and families of the Middle East. Comfort those who grieve. Protect the vulnerable. And raise up peacemakers who will draw from the deep wells of faith and courage. We remember the hundreds of thousands who are displaced. And O God, be with the people of this church who struggle for health, who fight with depression, loneliness, the struggle to keep hope alive, those who seek housing in the midst of shortage. O God, speak to us according to our need, and may we have a sense of your grace and presence, your hand upon our shoulder. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.